Maria Rodel, while grateful for her heritage that is synonymous with the origins of organic farming in America, is feeling the freedom of choosing her own path, finally. And the three ingredients of her focus are the title of her latest book, Love, Nature, Magic. Thanks for joining us. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Maria, shamanism and journeying is shedding a light on and legitimizing a collective desire to recognize and get in sync with source. And it's such a great avenue of discovery that's becoming almost like an 8-lane highway. And I'm wondering if you would please tell us about how you came to use this beautiful tool.
Well, I started journeying about 10 years ago when I did a workshop at Esalen in California, and it tapped into something that just not only amazed and surprised me, but I realized I'd also been doing it on my own.
Yes.
For a long time. So it was something I'd kept very private because, you know, people consider stuff like that woo-woo, and, you know, I was a CEO at the time, and so it was just something I did for personal insight and reflection and guidance. But when I had an experience trying to communicate with a plant that was really annoying the heck out of me, and I was able to change my whole perspective on that plant, is when I started to realize, oh, this is a tool for speaking with nature in a way that is so powerful and so important.
And hopefully you were able to use it as a tool when you were a CEO speaking to those in the business world.
Well, I could use shamanic journeying to help me with business decisions and plan for the future, but I couldn't really talk to anybody about it except one or two people who were very close to me, including my assistant, who actually was the first person I knew to go to see a shaman, and it transformed her life. So that's when I started really believing in it.
Yes, and you write about the reverence people have when they journey. How do you experience that?
Well, I do think that reverence is important, but also sense of humor and being real is just as important. You know, there's a lot of I would say false reverence in the spiritual world. And, you know, what I found is that when I'm journeying, spirit and nature has an amazing sense of humor. They're often shocking and surprising and, you know, brutally honest. And so it's sort of like made me comfortable be who I am and not try to be some holier than thou something or other, because none of us are perfect and we're all just kind of trying to figure things out. So I have a healthy dose of irreverence that I bring to shamanism.
I like that. I feel like that's so true. I've certainly encountered that same thing, and spirit does shine through with a wicked sense of humor often.
That's right. But having said that, it's really important to protect yourself when you're traveling in the spirit world, you know, because not every spirit is a good spirit. You know, opening sacred space, closing sacred space, kind of being respectful, that is really important and deserving of respect.
Definitely, yes. And now that Love, Nature, Magic, your book, is out in the world, does it feel like the writing of the book was a journeying in itself?
Well, it definitely, the whole process was an act of journeying. And, you know, every journey in that book happened in the order with which I write about it, builds on each journey that happened. But now that it's out in the world, what's been amazing is how, first of all, the journey continues. I'm continually learning more and more about each of the plants, each of the beings, and I'm connecting with people whole new ways that actually give them permission to talk about this stuff. That, like, you know, we've all been keeping secrets.
Yes, certainly that is so true. Everyone's coming out of a closet of sorts.
Exactly. And it's really joyful and magical, for sure.
Oh, beautiful, yeah. Well, tell us about your process in writing this book. Did it become your original concept, or were there left or right 90-degree turns during the process?
Well, I had actually written a whole other book, Love. I was really interested in, like, how do you learn to love? And, you know, especially if you come from, you know, some difficult situations, or you've been through, you know, we live in a kind of challenging society. And so I did a much more of a, like, a self-help research-based book on love. And nobody wanted to publish it, which was kind of like, oh, okay, you know, I don't own a publishing company anymore, so I can't just publish it on my own. I need to find, I mean, I could have self-published, but I have respect for the what publishers bring to doing a book. So kind of like put it on the shelf. And then, like I said, I was out gardening one day trying to eradicate mugwort, and I felt it trying to get my attention. And that experience is what made me think, like, after I journeyed about mugwort, I was like, maybe there's something here. Maybe the plants want me to speak for them. You know, maybe nature is asking me. Because throughout many of my journeys, I got the message, you know, be the voice for nature, be a voice for nature. And I was like, I don't know what that means. So after I got about 3 or 4 journeys under my belt is when I started, and, you know, chapters about the different beings is when I reached out to some friends to read it. And they liked it, so I thought, okay, I'm not crazy. Then I found my editor, Fern, who was somebody I had known for a long time, but she was at Chelsea Green, which is like the, you know, in fact, Spirit had been whispering to me in my ear, you know, Chelsea Green. And I was like, okay, yeah, you know, that's a good small independent publisher. And when I looked at their website and saw Fern, my friend Fern was an editor there, I was like, here we go, okay. So it felt like I was guided all along the way. But, you know, when they signed the book for me, I hadn't written it yet. And they were like, well, where's this going to go? And I was like, I don't know where it's going to go. And, you know, if you read the book, you know that fungi is the last chapter.
Yes.
And that was something, like, I had not planned on or expected, and it was actually, like, the perfect ending for the book. And what I realized after writing it was that I had written the book about love before, but I actually hadn't really learned how to love myself from doing that. But through journeying and understanding and talking with, you know, all these plants and pests, mosquito and tick, I actually felt like I had learned finally how to really love. And I felt an enormous amount of love in my heart that I hadn't felt before. So
yes, it's so evident, isn't it, that love really is a conversation. And I think it really starts with listening.
Exactly.
And I'm glad you brought up that chapter on fungus or fungi, because I really wanted to dive into that a little bit, because you bring your experience of having ringworm that wouldn't go away into a focus, and you journeyed on it, and it immediately started receding and finally disappeared after a week, but as you write, you kept using the antifungal cream just in case, as you put it. And I want to go into that just in case, because what is it with humans and trust, right? I'm wondering, did you do a journey about the just in case? I'm just wondering, what have you learned about letting go of fear? Because we're all sort of hung up in this just in case.
Well, I think actually what I learned from that process, and I'm continuing to learn, and I'll tell you a story about that, is that I grew up in the whole, you know, natural health world, and, you know, there's this kind of like demonization of doctors and pharmaceuticals and all that stuff. But I think it's a balance. Like, I don't think we should expect that spirit alone is going to heal everything necessarily, unless something really special happens, which it sometimes does. For example, I recently got a tick bite. And as you know, I wrote a chapter on ticks in my book, and I was like, oh, you know, darn it. And I took it off, and like, well, if something happens in 2 weeks, I'll go to the doctor. And, you know, what happened in 2 weeks was that the bite got infected. And, you know, I know from doing research that if I wouldn't have taken the antibiotics that they gave me, I'd probably die from that infection. You know, so there's a limit to what spirit is going to do for us. It's like that story where, you know, God sends you a boat in a flood. That's God saving you. Right. You got to get in the boat.
Yes.
But you also have to understand, and I still don't understand why I got infected from the tick bite, but, you know, like, what is the root of why you got infected in the first place? So with, you know, with the ringworm, I had been thinking about death a lot, and, you know, fungus is kind of a decomposer, and so I had to really change my thinking about that. So, I don't know, I think just in case is okay to be prepared, to be flexible, you know, to cover your bases. So I don't know if that's what you are going for, but that's how I feel about it.
I'm going for your feeling about it, obviously. We're doing an interview with you right now. So you write also that the concept of healing has always been a lifelong mission for you. And you just gave us a bit of an insight about healing. Is there other truth that you found that clarifies the concept of healing for you, perhaps differently than the way you grew up?
Well, as I said, I mean, I really grew up surrounded by people with strong opinions about what, you know, what creates good health and what creates bad health and what is, you know, natural health versus unnatural health. You know, and for example, when I was younger, you know, the whole natural pregnancy and, you know, birth movement was really strong. And, you know, I have three children. Two of them would not be alive if I had been doing a natural birth. And I've studied a lot of women's history, and throughout history, you know, women have just died in droves giving birth. So I think nature wants us to be intelligent about what we do, but at the same time, we have to take responsibility for how we do it and what we do and what we eat and how we exercise. And it's not like black and white. I think it's different for every single person.
Of course, yes.
And you have to find what works for you.
Yes, that's such a key point, especially in this day of the internet and everyone's got a way that they did it. And I think it was so much more powerful for you to have this book, Love, Nature, Magic, because in writing a self-help book about love, I'm sure that was your entry into this other book, which may or may not have more relatable information. I don't know. Perhaps that other book will be published at a later date. I don't know at this point. But I loved also how you draw feeling love into the weight of our souls and some history about how the Egyptians consider the heart. Could you share some about that?
Right. So the Egyptians believed that when you die, your heart would be weighed on a scale by the god or goddess, I can't remember, Mot. And if your heart was as light as a feather, you could proceed to a better place. And if your heart was not as light as a feather, you could not proceed to a better place. So that was in my chapter about the vulture. And, you know, vultures are often symbols of death because they eat dead things. And what I learned from that experience was that our hearts, in order to be as light as a feather, really need to be filled with love. Now, love doesn't have a weight or a mass, or you can't measure it, but it lifts all things and creates a lightness of being and spirit that is the most powerful thing of all. The hardest to define, but the most powerful.
Yes, and I can't believe I'm going to do this, but I'm going to tell you the latest joke that I heard.
Okay, what?
I recently weighed a rainbow. Now you can
you
say
weighed a rainbow.
Yeah, now you can say how much did it weigh?
How much did it weigh?
Well, I can't tell you exactly, but it was pretty light.
That's a good one.
I like hearing jokes that I can actually tell to 10-year-olds, you know what I mean? Or 6-year-olds. So one thing I did want to ask you, which perhaps I should have done earlier when you were talking about it, but at one point in your book, you say you are not a witch. And what is a witch?
Well, I think of a witch, and there's nothing wrong with being a witch. You know, I think a witch is somebody who is more involved with creating potions or what's the word, you know, like I'm going to use the word hexes, you know, or trying to make things happen through energy and plants and spells and things like that. Like I don't want to get involved in that personally. I'm more like, I'm just going to trust the universe.
I'm with you. I know there's such a fine line, isn't there, between people have intent, and it's good to feel purpose, but I can see where you were going with that definition, because trusting the universe, I couldn't agree more, is the way to go. You know, one thing that we haven't brought up yet, Maria, is that when you picked up journeying, you were not into ayahuasca or any of the plant helpers. And I'm wondering, you certainly were able to dive in and really get the gist of what this tool is about. Is the general consensus that one can just get started and really do this? What's your experience in speaking with others who have done the journeying without the plant medicine?
Almost everybody I've spoken to journeys does not use plant medicine to do it. You don't need it. Plant medicine is something to be like super respectful and careful about for very specific purposes. In fact, you know, my friend, Dr. Maya Sheetreat, just wrote a book called Master Plants. And that's, you know, a really good basic primer on how all the plants work. Even the shamans who ingested those plants often believe that you don't need to even ingest the plants to get access to the wisdom of them. So I mean, I, you know, full disclosure, I did LSD when I was a teenager. So I understand what happens and how it works. And I've had, you know, I had some experiences, but, you know, I also knew I didn't need that to continue. So I think it's great that plant medicine is becoming more accessible to people, but I also think it's super easy to use it as a crutch or just for fun, and I'm not interested in that.
Right.
You don't need plant medicine to journey, period. And you don't need to be a shaman. I am not a shaman. I have no desire to become a shaman.
Well, along those lines, as you freely admit, you are a recovering CEO, and at a glance, we can see that you have worn many hats in your life. Is there a point where it felt like your life really was truly an artistic collaboration of many things? I think as we age, it becomes that more and more rather than these random events. And I'm just wondering how you've experienced that.
Yeah, I mean, the cliche is that life itself is a journey. And it's not a highway. It's a crazy, random, you know, curving road trip. And there were many, many times when I was like, wait, why am I here? What am I doing? Is this who I really am? And, you know, each of those experiences kind of redirected me back to who I wanted to be and who I was meant to be. And when we sold the company, the family business, about, I think, 2018, it was the first time in my life where I was completely free from other people's expectations of what or who I should be. And that's when, like, all the dust settled from, you know, I'm 61 years old from my whole life. And I was able to see, you know, what do I love? You know, I love writing. I love gardening. I love communicating with nature and spirit and doing good things for the world. But I could also see that every single thing I'd done before helped me to do what I'm doing now even better.
Yeah, I think it's so important to not judge our progress or our path, but to just really treat it as a journey, as you say, and that allows us to go into the deeper meaning and find the next step more easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and have fun along the way.
Oh, yes. Good point. You know, as a gardener and being of English descent, I wanted to hear more about the garden of your grandparents. You said it looked more European than American. What is that distinction for you?
Well, you have to remember that for most people, when they think of organic gardening, they're thinking of either hippies, kind of wild and crazy structures or, you know, landscapes, or they're thinking of, you know, the victory gardener who had great rows and wanted to grow giant tomatoes, who, God bless them, they were the first organic gardening subscribers. The garden that my grandparents created, well, you know, they bought a farm in Pennsylvania that had been really run down, completely run down, but it had good potential. And, you know, it's a traditional Pennsylvania farmhouse. They improved it, basically built like this idyllic world to live in with stone walls and a beautiful greenhouse and this like fairy tale little cottage bakehouse and, you know, stone steps leading up to magical gardens. Both of my grandparents were, you know, very creative and artistic and literary, even though they had grown up with nothing. So it was like their version of the American dream, and, you know, but it was a a European dream as well, because they were reading and studying Lady Eve Balfour and Sir Albert Howard and the great thinkers of British soil, soil and composting science. So still there today.
Sounds beautiful, you know, yes. Sounds very beautiful. Peaceful.
It belongs to the Rodale Institute now, and it's really a magical place.
Yes, well, it's a wonderful heritage that you've experienced and get to share. One last question, Maria. What book are you reading, or what's the most recent book you've read?
Well, I actually am reading Dr. Maya Seatreat's book on master plants. Mm. So that is something, you know, that is interesting to me. And plus, she's a friend of mine. So, you know, she really actually helped me in the transition from the self-help world to the love, nature, magic world. Mm. And I'm learning a lot. I'm learning a lot from reading her book.
Beautiful. And it's great. It's nice to finally meet you virtually. I've certainly been aware of you, and Rodale Tributaries has been all about holistic everything for many, many, many years. And so, yeah, as I just said, you come from a great heritage. And I can also see how it was so freeing when you got out of the family business, so to speak, and I'm so happy for you that you have many years to enjoy now being another facet of Maria Rodale.
Thank you so much. It was such a lovely conversation. Oh. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. You know, and I just for, I don't know why, but FYI, tooting horn perhaps, but I also have a podcast I do on regenerative agriculture called Cultivated Audio, and that I started that just a monthly podcast in 2020, and it's just been so great being able to have that as a sole focus as well. And there's a lot of great things coming down the pike.
What's funny, in full disclosure, is in preparing for the call today, I thought you were going to interview me for that. So I haven't actually listened to the podcast you do that this is for.
Oh, yes.
It's great. It's perfect. I love this conversation. So thank you.
Yeah,
it was
my pleasure.
Much more fun to me than talking about regenerative ag. But I
yeah. No, that's not your jam. I'm going to do that at 10 in another 30 minutes. I'm going to be doing that with a first generation shepherd in Southern California.
Oh.
For anything tributaries related, including this interview with Maria Rodale, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.